On today's first underreported segment, we're taking a look at the struggles within New York's Independence Party as various interest groups vie for influence and for its valuable ballot line. Joining me now is Sal Gentile, a reporter for City Hall, a biweekly political magazine. I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Sal.
Hi, Leonard.
Has the Independence Party had much of an ideology in the past, or has it basically been a ballot line? I mean, didn't it grow out of Ross Perot's presidential bid in 1992?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. It grew out of Ross Perot's presidential bid. But, you know, as it started to become influential in the city, it never really had sort of a discernible political ideology in the way that we would think of, for example, the Republican or Democratic parties. You always hear rhetoric about wanting to nominate nonpartisan, independent candidates that are not owned or controlled by the major parties. But, for example, on standard issues, whether they be social issues, economic issues, there isn't sort of a discernible platform for the Independence Party. It's sort of turned into just a ballot line to use for people or candidates who want to differentiate themselves in some ways from the major parties that have nominated them.
But I have always associated Tom Golisano with the party, and he's like a Ross Perot type, once a Republican. Is his role still really big upstate?
Yeah, well, that's true. And that sort of gets at sort of the differences between the Independence Party upstate and in the city, which is has been a struggle for some time now. Tom Golisano still certainly exerts influence upstate. He's sort of come in and out of the picture. There is a state chairman who is also the national chairman of the party. And so he tries to control it along with the executive committee of the party. And so they're at least theoretically independent from Tom Golisano. And so they have their own priorities. They have their own values that they want to pursue. But there is still, of course, an informal connection between Tom Golisano and the people who work for him and the Independence Party. And there have been struggles across the state, for example, between committee members who want to nominate one candidate and Tom Golisano and his people who want to name another candidate, for example.
But he is basically, and most of the people upstate seem to me to be former Republicans or people who are a bit more conservative than what we've been seeing in the city. The New York City branch of the Independence Party is controlled by Fred Newman and Lenora Filani. Haven't they described themselves as socialists in the past?
Yeah, they have. And that's another sort of reason why, you know, the actual, at least if you go according to what, if they describe to you, for example, what they want the Independence Party to be, they don't any longer use any sort of rhetoric that would resemble socialism. They talk more about just wanting independent candidates that are not subject to special interests or influence from special interests, whether they be labor unions or major parties. They, in fact, it's sort of become reformed at this point. They're trying to over the past few years, they've tried to change that image because, you know, now they nominate mainstream candidates like Mayor Bloomberg. So, according to them, their platform is simply that they want independent candidates in office. But there definitely is a difference between what, for example, a city candidate on the Independence Party ballot line would be running for example, than somebody upstate.
Well, have there been any clashes between the city group and the state Independence Party, which I guess is run by Frank McKay, the chair of its chair?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a power struggle going on?
Well, there has been for the past few years, and there still is. Basically, what happened is the City Independence Party, the faction controlled by Lenora Filani and Fred Newman, controlled who got their ballot line, both in the citywide elections, for example, in elections for comptroller and public advocate and mayor, and as well in city council elections. And that was how it went for some years. And then the state party, because they were disenchanted with the leaders of the city party, because the city party was controversial for things that Lenora Filani had said, for example, and Fred Newman had done in the past, they tried to wrest control of all of that from them. They tried to rewrite the rules. The leaders of the city party took that to court. And sort of in an odd ruling, and this has been the way it's been for about the past year or so, The court ruled that the state party could have control over city council elections in the city, but not over the citywide ballots. So that's why, for example, Lenora Fulani and Fred Newman get to decide that Mayor Bloomberg can run on the Independence Party line citywide, but the state party now controls the ballot line in city elections, which has also created a very interesting situation where you have state election law in many ways applying to city council elections.
How much input does Mayor Bloomberg have in the city's branch of the Independence Party?
Well, because he's their nominee on the mayoral line, and also because he has donated so much money to their party, essentially what they do is funded by Mayor Bloomberg in many ways in the city. At this point, the way it's been described to me by members of the Independence Party in the city, people who do the screening for the candidates, people on the executive committee, he gets essentially to assent to who gets the ballot line in city elections. Now, certainly it's not always the case that he exerts his influence, and in most cases I would imagine that the mayor himself is not personally involved, but his aides and his deputies in some cases will say, we want X person to have the ballot line in this race, or we don't want this person to have the ballot line in another race, and so forth.
How much of this is an attempt to marginalize the Working Families Party?
Well, that right now is currently the effort underway. The Working Families Party is a coalition of progressive interest groups, primarily labor unions, for example, that have just grown their influence enormously over the past several years. In many ways, they're responsible for policy changes, major policy changes at the state level, in the city council, in Democratic primaries. They're extremely influential.
And you would have thought that Fred Newman, based on his past history, would be a kind of simpatico with them.
Yeah, and that's also sort of an odd thing, although and it's not necessarily that he isn't, although I think to try to say consistent with their rhetoric about being independent and nonpartisan, they try not to associate with any other parties in the city. When you talk to them, they try to be very clear about the fact that the Independence Party doesn't work with any other party or coordinate with any other party. But the people behind this push to counteract the influence of the Working Families Party are actually at the state level. And they are, for example, just now allying themselves with interests that are opposed to the Working Families Party's policy agenda, for example, business interests and real estate interests in New York City.
So who do you think is going to be appearing on the Independence Party ballot line this fall? Are they more likely to be Republicans, Democrats, conservative Democrats?
Well, in the city council elections this year in the fall, you've got basically two things going on. The first thing is that in Democratic primaries, so in districts where only a Democrat could win and the Democratic primary is all that matters, you have multiple Democrats running against each other, and the Independence Party chooses one of those Democrats, not necessarily because the ballot line is influential, but because as an independent organization and an independent party, the Independence Party can take money from, for example, major donors like the real estate lobby and the business lobby, and use that money on behalf of the candidates it chooses. So we've already seen some of this happening. There are conservative Democrats running in council districts across the city that the Independence Party is now sending out literature on behalf of and funding other operations on behalf of their campaigns. These are at least nominally independent expenditures on their behalf. But if you have the money, for example, that the real estate lobby and the business lobby have behind you, it could potentially be very influential in those races.
My guest is Sal Gentile, a reporter for City Hall, and we're talking about the state and local independence parties on the first of our underreported segments today. The Independence Party has collected tens of thousands of dollars in donations from some of the city's biggest real estate developments, Tishman Speyer, a landlord group called the Rent Stabilization Association. Why are they interested in working with the Independence Party?
Well, so, you know, it really started earlier this year when the state Senate, which has just been taken over by Democrats in the last election last year, had to fill a very large gap in the state budget. It was about $14 billion gap. And they had to do that earlier this year, and they had to figure out a way. The main way that they did it basically was a combination of tax increases on the highest earners in the state and fees and so forth. And that was very controversial in the business community. That was something that most, or if not all, business groups and real estate groups in the city and statewide opposed. Tom Golisano famously said he would move to Florida if the state Senate passed a tax increase. That's also part of the reason why he helped instigate the coup that stalled the Senate for a month earlier this year. And so because of all the anger over that, and because they felt that that policy change was fueled in large part by the influence of the Working Families Party and the labor unions that support them, they decided to look for another independent organization that they could fund, that they could channel their money into, to use to try to influence elections in both the city and the state. And so this fall's city council elections are sort of a test of that influence. If the money that they've channeled into the Independence Party does in fact have an impact, if they can help elect candidates that are somewhat sympathetic to their agenda, then they'll ramp up that even more and amplify their efforts next year in the state Senate elections and the legislature in 2010.
Well, the Independence Party had a connection to the coup as well, because the last time you were on our show, it was to talk about state Senate Majority Leader Pedro Espada Jr., who was the key figure in that coup. And he's always enjoyed the backing of Fred Newman and Lenora Filani. In fact, he ran first on a different political party that they ran. So they are implicated in that coup as well, aren't they?
They absolutely are. I mean, you know, as we talked about last time, Senator Espada's career basically was established by the people who now run the Independence Party. As you mentioned, he ran initially on a ballot line with the New Alliance Party, which was a predecessor to the Independence Party. And, you know, just initially in his career, as well as later, he has always enjoyed their support. It's often been crucial in his elections. And Tom Golisano so that's the city faction, the state faction. Tom Golisano was directly involved in the coup. So that's just one example of the influence that this party wields both in the city and upstate. And they're trying to amplify that influence even more now.
I was wondering about that real estate aspect when that story broke this week about Pedro Espada naming a new deputy chief of staff, Onyx A. Sosa, who turned out to have managed dozens of low-income buildings that had numerous housing code violations. And Espada said he was unaware of Sosa's record, but it's hard to believe that even the most minimal background check wouldn't have turned that up.
Yeah, right. And this is just sort of – and the crucial context for this is that Espada has always had a very poor relationship with, for example, tenant activists and the rest of his Democratic conference, which is largely dominated by tenant-friendly legislators from the city, progressives who favor all sorts of policy changes that would favor tenants and, for example, strengthen rent regulation. He's always disagreed with those things. He's always been or at least critics have alleged that he's an ally of landlords and real estate interests. And so this is just another incident in a long line of incidents that have made tenant activists feel as though Espada, who wields incredible influence in the Senate at the moment, is against their interests.
It's hard to believe that a man who came across as something of a clown, actually, would wield so much influence in the Senate. Is it simply because his coup worked for him?
Basically, essentially what happened is that they affirmed his strategy. If he has shown the Senate that at any time he could change his allegiance or demand one thing or another, and they'll have to at least hear him out because, he could throw the chamber into chaos at any time now. I mean, for example, everybody knows that he's under investigation for multiple potential offenses by both the Attorney General and the State Board of Elections and so forth. And yet the Senate, the leaders of the Senate still had to allocate to him one of the highest portions of funding for community projects this year, basically earmarks that he gets to dole out. He had one of the highest portions of that, so they still have to heed his demands because they know about what happened earlier this year. He could very easily do it again.
And hasn't he said that he still consults with Fred Newman over strategies, political strategies?
Yeah, last time I talked to him, for example, when I wrote a story about his connections to the Independence Party and the New Alliance Party, he told me, and more, and even Fred Newman told me in interviews that they speak occasionally, that it's not just a matter of the Independence Party sort of strategically supporting him, that they share a political viewpoint, and that Fred Newman, for example, supports whatever Espada does in the Senate, including instigating the coup earlier this year. So it's definitely true that they continue to talk occasionally, and that they share strategy and the political philosophy.
We have to take a little break. We'll be back with more on this with Sal Gentile, a reporter for City Hall. We're talking about state versus local independence parties. This is WNYC. We're back with Sal Gentile, reporter for City Hall. We are talking about the Independence Party and the split in the party as part of today's underreported. Last year, the New York State Court of Appeals handed down two rulings. One affected the Working Families Party, and the other was about the Independence Party. How did those rulings change control of the state and city ballot lines?
Well, so in regard to the Independence Party, the ruling essentially said that the city Independence Party could control citywide ballot lines in the city and the state, and then the state party could control the rest of the ballot lines, including the city council here. I'm not sure which ruling you're referring to with the Working Families Party, though.
Well, it's irrelevant to this conversation. I just thought because of the fight between the two that it's interesting that both are out there fighting for ballot lines. But the Independence Party disbanded its organization in Brooklyn, Queens, and the Bronx, didn't it? Or at least the state party did? Disassociate itself from Lenore Filani?
Yeah, that's right. That's correct. Because those it's sort of interesting when you try to talk to people. There are sort of these independence parties, shadow independence parties of people in those boroughs who contend that they are still sort of the leaders of the Brooklyn Independence Party, even though, at least according to the rules or according to the ruling handed down last year, they're not. Those organizations, as you mentioned, were disbanded, but there are still activists out there who still want to try to somehow reorganize the party or try to rewrite the rules to regain their influence. And so that's part of the struggle that goes back and forth.
Well, if people in the party want to disassociate themselves from Fred Newman and Lenore Filani, largely because of alleged anti-Semitic comments they made in the past, some of the other things that they've done in the past, why do you think that doesn't seem to bother Mayor Bloomberg, doesn't seem to bother Charles Schumer, and didn't seem to bother Elliot Spitzer when he depended on the Independence Party for a ballot line?
Well, for them, it's really more of a transactional matter. I think, you know.
But we're talking about three major Jewish politicians in New York.
Yeah, right. No, and that's a criticism that many people have lobbed at all three of them, especially Mayor Bloomberg. You know, in every one of his elections, especially in 2001, the Independence Party line has been crucial. And in 2001, it provided the decisive number of votes. And so you could argue that without the Independence Party, he wouldn't have won in 2001. But, you know, that's a criticism that's been lobbed in all three. Somehow they've been able to insulate themselves from it. They've never had to they've never been asked and they've never really talked about whether or not they actually agree with the philosophy of these leaders or the parties themselves. And, you know, I think it's partially just because, you know, people have sort of taken, at least the people in the political establishment in New York have sort of taken the Independence Party's ballot line as just sort of a pro forma matter. Every year somebody tries to win the Independence Party line and you know, we just sort of take it for granted that this is just an empty ballot line that people want to use to try to gain an advantage over their opponents, and that's pretty much the way it's become. It's viewed at this point, but it, certainly it's a criticism that people have tried at least to lob against the politicians that use the line.
You've written about Pedro Espada. You've also written about Hiram Mansourat. They were the two key figures in the coup. Do you think that they're going to be able to stay in power? Will they both be facing serious challengers in the next elections?
Well, it's an interesting question in both cases. In the first of Pedro Espada, for example, I think most people agree that it's very hard to see how, for example, the people who oppose the spot or anybody really would be able to mount a viable primary challenge against him next year. I mean, certainly you couldn't run a Republican against him in that district, so it would have to be somebody running against him in the Democratic primary. And it's just hard to see who would do that because you know, despite the fact that in many corners of the state, the Pedro spot has been criticized and even vilified by some people, in his district, because he has a network of nonprofits, the Soundview Health Clinic, has been there for several decades that he's running that. And, you know, because he is directly involved in providing services to people, he's very popular in certain areas of that district. And so it's likely that he's going to stay there. Whether or not he continues to have the same amount of power that he does now, of course, depends on whether or not the Democrats can increase their margins in the Senate. If they can elect a few more Democrats from the rest of the state and they have a larger margin of the Republicans, they won't depend on every single vote. And so Espada's power will be reduced. And as far as Hiram Montserrat goes, in that situation, it's actually much more likely that Montserrat will not be able to survive. For example, he'll be on trial this month on the 15th is the first day of his trial for allegedly abusing his girlfriend. And that's sort of a saga that's gone on for a few months now. And that'll be a felony charge. If he's convicted, he's immediately removed from office. And there are people in his district that are lining up to potentially run either after he leaves office or potentially against him.
When Espada became the majority leader, wasn't Montserrat expected to take over his seat on the housing committee?
There were rumors.
We're back to real estate here.
I'm sorry?
We're back to real estate.
Right. Well, and it actually plays an incredibly the real estate community and interest and policy issues with regard to both real estate and tenant issues are actually playing an incredibly influential role in what happens to the Democratic Senate this year, both politically in terms of who the real estate industry supports and also within the conference. The conference is fractured in many ways over real estate issues and tenant issues, and so that produces a lot of friction. But there were rumors when Pedro Espada became majority leader that Hiram Montserrat might inherit the housing committee. Those rumors haven't gone away, although the Senate Democrats haven't decided yet who will take the housing committee, and that doesn't have to be decided until next year, so I think they're trying to sort of dampen that. But it's still possible that Hiram Montserrat will get that seat. We're just not sure yet.
Do you think the Independence Party is becoming the party of the real estate interests? Is that where they see themselves going?
I think at least explicitly on their part, they'll tell you that they are becoming a party that is supportive of business and of the real estate industry and of developers, communities they feel have been under siege from other interest groups like labor unions. I think they'll definitely tell you that. I think how much influence those interests have within the Independence Party definitely depends on how successful they are this year. As I mentioned earlier, if they see that their investment in the Independence Party, that the hundreds of thousands of dollars that they've been channeling into the party, does in fact pay off, if they can elect candidates in the city this year who are sympathetic to their agenda, I think they'll definitely increase that effort. And, you know, even now, a significant percentage of the Independence Party's money comes from those interests. And so that percentage would only increase if they're successful this year. And so it's very possible that the Independence Party would primarily become the party of business and real estate in New York City and in New York State.
We've been talking about the split in the Independence Party, but it's interesting that the coup in the state Senate was facilitated by two figures, largely Tom Golisano and Pedro Espada, who has been connected with the New York City branch. Do you think that they were working together?
Tom Golisano and Pedro Espada?
Yeah.
Definitely. Actually, that's been something that's been reported that people I've talked to have confirmed that there was definitely a coordinated effort to do this, to swing control of the chamber to Republicans. Now, of course, the intended effort, the intention, I should say, wasn't to throw the chamber into chaos for a protracted period of time. They simply wanted the Republicans to have the majority until the elections next year. But there was definitely a coordinated effort, and much of that had to do with the influence of Tom Golisano representing the interests of big business. And actually, one thing that people don't really remember is that leaders of the real estate community, for example, the Real Estate Board of New York, the Rent Stabilization Association, which is a landlord group, were actually integrally involved in the coup as well. They were there on the day that the coup took place. They were there back and forth throughout the month that the Democrats and Republicans struggled, because there are a number of initiatives in the legislature right now that they want to stall that are sponsored by Democrats from the city. And if the Democrats can grow their margins in the Senate, they will potentially pass those. So, you know, that's something actually that doesn't really get mentioned as much, but it's they played a crucial role as well.
So will they be challenging the Democrats in the next election to make it harder for them to maintain control of the Assembly and the Senate?
I think how much they oppose the Democrats remains to be seen. Certainly, there's certainly a lot of overlap between the Democratic Party and the Working Families Party. I think they'll certainly oppose the Working Families Party to try to prevent progressive or what they might see as, you know, a liberal far left Democrats from taking over the chamber. They might still support Democrats that they feel are acceptable to them, people who are sympathetic to the business and real estate concerns. So it might not be sort of a wholesale opposition to the Democratic Party, but certainly to progressive Democrats that are supported by the Working Families Party. And that could definitely create problems for the Democrats next year in trying to increase their margins in the Senate.
When you spoke to the State Independence Party Chair Frank McKay, he told you that his big goal was to run a viable candidate for president in 2012. Had you heard anything like that before from the Independence Party?
There were public musings about it from Frank McKay. He had this dream of running Mayor Bloomberg for president in 2008, and as sort of rumors of Mayor Bloomberg running for president were gaining steam, he had never explicitly mentioned to anyone that he would run as the Independence Party candidate, just that he would run as a third candidate against the Republican and Democratic nominees. But Frank McKay had been going around crisscrossing the country, trying to build support for Mayor Bloomberg, trying to say that he was the candidate of the Independence Party, and also trying to use that as a platform to grow the Independence Party nationally. That was sort of the root of that. Now, obviously, Mayor Bloomberg did not run for president, and so that initiative was cut short. But now they are certainly planning on taking the party national and, you know, without Mayor Bloomberg, trying to establish a viable presidential candidate in 2012.
Well, it was a national party under Ross Perot. Do other Independence Party entities exist around the country that could be brought together again?
There are some parties, for example, in Minnesota. There's an Independence Party, and Mayor Bloomberg actually has traveled to Minnesota to help the Independence Party there raise money. So there are Independence Parties in different states. It depends on the politics of each state, how viable the chapters of the Independence Party there are. Obviously, the Independence Party in New York is very viable. In Minnesota as well, there are a few other states.
Well, they elected a governor in Minnesota, Jesse Ventura.
That's right. So, you know, there are definitely a handful of states where the Independence Party is viable. That also has to do with sort of the election laws in New York. We have a system of fusion voting that allows minor parties to pool their votes with major parties together to support one candidate. And so that makes the Independence Party influential. But those laws are not very common in the United States. So there are only a handful of states where the Independence Party is still influential. But, you know, if they can raise enough money and establish more chapters across the state, they certainly can be influential.
So do you see them as a party that's kind of a mix of moderate Republicans and blue dog Democrats?
I think, you know, that's probably a pretty accurate way to think about it. Certainly we see in New York right now that the party is supporting both Republicans in both the upcoming fall elections and probably next year in 2010. And also conservative Democrats in primaries where the conservative Democrats are running against the more liberal opponents. So that's probably a pretty accurate way to think about it. I think the overriding factor, of course, is how sympathetic they are to the business and real estate community's interests.
And you have to wonder whether what would happen on the national front if they succeeded, because there seems to be a move to merge moderate Republicans and blue dog Democrats around the country.
It's very possible that they might be picking up on something that's already in place, obviously what we've seen and what is interesting about that is that a commonly cited fact is that there are more small-I independents, unaffiliated voters, nationally now than there have been in decades.
Sal, I have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you so much for talking with us, Sal Gentile of City Hall. On tomorrow's show, we'll rebroadcast some of our favorite recent interviews, starting off with Arianna Huffington talking about what and who she thinks were behind the current economic crisis, and then a woman who thought she was menopausal and had a tumor, only to discover that she was, in fact, 6 months pregnant. Also, Colin McCann on his latest novel, Let the Great World Spin, which is set against the backdrop of Philippe Petit's tightrope walk between the Twin Towers in 1974. Plus, Suzanne Simons gives us an inside look at the company formerly known as Blackwater. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Nicole Silbersack and Adam Delahanty. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.